There's no mistaking what this, in fact, really is. It's a massive voice of protest against the rule of the Shah.
Good evening. Now we know the United States has passed the word to the Shah of Iran. It's time for him to leave his country.
The political initiative now lies totally with the Ayatollah. Now that he's back, he'll very soon announce the establishment of a government of his own.
There might have been tears in the eyes of the Shah as he took to the streets of the capital in their thousands to celebrate the departure of the man they have hated for so long.
My name is David Burnett. I'm a photographer. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, in the western part of the U.S. And on Christmas Day, I flew from Karachi to Tehran. And there was something about it, and I can't even say what at this point, but I just had a feeling that came out of that day that this was going to be something that wasn't going to go away quickly. Announced at that New Year's Day press conference that he was going to take a vacation. Everyone interpreted as, oh, that means the Shah is leaving the country, which he actually did some days later. Kind of proved to be the last attempt of the Shah to retain power, but that didn't work. Half a million or maybe a million people at a rally. It was just gigantic, and the scale of it was hard to believe. An active story, it was changing all the time, and no one really knew what was going to happen next. My name is David Burnett. I'm a photographer. Been a photographer for close to 50 years. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, in the western part of the U.S. And when I was in high school at age 16, I started taking photographs. I was shooting pictures for the high school newspaper and the yearbook. And I knew really nothing about photography until my junior year of high school, and that's where I kind of figured out that it was really fun to take pictures and to develop the negatives and make prints. And for me, it was really a transformative experience. And even though I had wanted to be an engineer and to work in the space program, that had been my long-term hope, I think. Once I started taking pictures, I pretty much knew that that's what I wanted to do. And all through college, even though I was a major in political science, I ended up taking pictures through all 4 years, both for the college and occasionally selling them to a magazine. And then I began working as a freelancer for Time Magazine, at first in Washington, D.C., and then later in Miami. And then in the summer of 1970, I decided that there was still enough work and questions to be asked in Vietnam, which was getting to be near the end of the Vietnam War, but it was still a place where there was a lot of things going on and a lot of work for photographers. So in the fall of 1970, I bought a ticket to Saigon and I ended up staying there for 2 years, working for both Time and Life magazine. When I came back from Vietnam in 1972, I was working for Life magazine as a contract photographer, and that was great. I was hoping maybe someday I'd be a Life staff photographer, but the magazine closed up in just a couple of months after I got home. So in the beginning of 1973, I had to really figure out what I was going to do, and I ended up spending 2 years working for the French agency Gamma, and did stories all over the world in that 2 years. And then after a couple of years of working with Gamma, I decided to start my own agency, and with my editor friend Robert Pledge, we started Contact Press Images. And that's really who I've worked for almost 40 years, or worked with. I wouldn't say worked for, but been a partner in the agency for all these years. In the good years and the bad years, and in the rich years and the lean years, and of course everybody has some of each. But it's been a great experience, and I'm still working now, even though the magazine world that I used to work for has pretty much disappeared. There's very much fewer assignments and work available than there used to be in the magazines. And the editors are much less inclined to want to pay for it. So it's really created a very different situation than that which I had in the first 40 or 45 years of working, when there were a lot of magazines and they had a lot of pages to fill and a lot of budget money to be able to have photographers create things. And a lot of that's just simply gone away. But it's a great thing to be a photographer, and to, you know, I sometimes think I've never had a real job, because I've only ever worked as a photojournalist doing something I really like doing. And I consider myself, because of that, pretty lucky. Not many people get to do what they enjoy doing for a job. The Shah of Iran came to the U.S. and had a state visit in Washington, which I covered. And that was the trip where much of the oil money from 73-74 was being spent to upgrade the Iranian Air Force. And I remember that they said, oh, this, you know, the Shah's been out at Andrews Air Force Base testing out the goods. He'd been out flying an F-14. And I think that's where the original deal happened, that Iran was buying F-14 fighters. I didn't see the Shah again until I arrived in Tehran in 1970. I arrived just at the end of 1978. There was a press conference that he and Farid Diba had on January 1st, on New Year's Day, at one of the palace. I forget which palace it was, then, frankly, but it was the last time that he met with the press. And it was at that moment where I had been in town for about a week. Most of the stuff I'd been doing was in the street or was related to street demonstrations. And this particular day, went to the palace and made pictures of this last press conference. And it was a few more days until the next government was named, which was the one led by Shapur Bakhtiar, and which kind of proved to be the last attempt of the Shah to retain power, but that didn't work. And he announced at that New Year's Day press conference that he was going to take a vacation, which everyone interpreted as, oh, that means the Shah is leaving the country, which he actually did some days later. And I remember going to the airport hoping to be able to get a picture of of him getting on the plane or some kind of a picture of departure. All we ever saw was the tail of the airplane. We never actually saw him again. The whole way that I even got to Iran was that I had been working in Pakistan and Balochistan for a couple of weeks in December of 1978. Finished the story there. And rather than just get on a plane and fly home to the States, those were still the days when you would always try and figure out how to maximize the value of an airline ticket, so that if someone was sending you from New York to Pakistan, virtually halfway around the world, you didn't want to just get on the plane and come home. You'd go somewhere else and try and figure out what else to do. And on Christmas Day, I flew from Karachi to Tehran. And within a few hours of being there and checking in at the Time Magazine Bureau, I was in my first street demonstration. And it was something that really struck me very strongly, that I had just arrived, but I was right in the middle of the battle between soldiers and a bunch of demonstrators. And there was something about it, and I can't even say what at this point, but I just had a feeling that came out of that day that this was going to be something that wasn't going to go away quickly. I ended up spending a little over 7 weeks in Tehran, and it was so interesting because you could see things happen on a daily basis, which led to a sense of a real change. You know, it was the Shah's departure, and then the intent to form a new government, then the return of Khomeini, and Mehdi Bazargan being named the new prime minister. It was a lot to happen in a couple of months. And to which you had to kind of add that every couple of weeks, or every few days in some cases, there would be these enormous rallies in the street where you would have 500,000 or maybe 1 million people at a rally. It was just gigantic, and the scale of it was hard to believe. But I mean, that's you can say the word 1 million people, or say those words, and it kind of means something, but photographically, it's very hard to photograph 1 million people. You know, you have to photograph a piece of it and let it seem like a lot of people. But the difference between 10,000 people and 1 million people, one is 1% and the other is 100%. But it's very hard to, in pictures, create the sense of what that many people is like. So that was kind of constantly a struggle, just to show these huge demonstrations and what they were all about. Many people had a hard time separating the fact that, say, I was an American photographer from the American regime. And even though you might try and explain it, you'd sometimes get into these very long discussions. I never once had any really bad times, except the fact that I was chased by the army and the cops a couple of times. But The people, by and large, were very friendly. They wanted the story told, and we were there to help just tell the story, and that included what people were up to, like at a big demonstration. It was really interesting. After a couple of weeks, when there had been a few incidents in some of the marches of people, oppressed people being bothered by the crowd, one of the reporters sent a message to his office in Paris saying, please try and get word to Khomeini's people that when there's a big demonstration, that, you know, the press is not the enemy here, we're just trying to report the story. So in one of the next broadcasts that Khomeini made from France, he said something to the effect, I don't know exactly how it was worded, but something to the effect that the foreign press should be treated as our guests. And I know that at the next rally that I went to, people went out of their way to try and be nice. And actually it was hilarious at one point. You know, when you have hundreds of thousands of people gathered, you can, and you're only my height, I don't even know what I am in meters. It's like 170 or something. I'm not very tall. But when you're trying to see what's going on, unless you're really elevated, you can't see so many people, but you need a little bit of elevation. So at one point, these four boys came along and said, hey, where are you from? And I said, well, I'm a French photographer, and that was okay. I got very used to saying I was French. And, well, is there anything we can do for you? And I said, well, you know, the only thing I can't really do now is see the crowd. Is there any way I could get up? And I barely had even finished saying the word up. And they all grabbed my feet and just lifted me up high, like 1.5 meters, 2 meters high. And all of a sudden, I had my own private little human tripod. And I was able to take some pictures, and they let me down, and I thanked them. There were a lot of things like that would happen at these big demonstrations. It wasn't just all politics and serious all the time. There's a story I tell about my friend Patrick Chauvel. At one of these big demonstrations, I was up on top of a truck just to get some, again, to get a little height. And through, slowly coming through the crowd was a bus filled with demonstrators, and on top of the bus was Patrick Chauvel, the French photographer. And he saw me, he kind of waved and held up his camera. And I don't know how I knew it, but basically he was just sort of pointing and shrugging his shoulders like, I'm out of film. Can you spare me a roll of film? So he's moving through the crowd, and I think between us it was probably like 25 or 30 meters. I reached in my pocket and I took out a roll of Tri-X, and I tried to figure out where he would be, and I threw it as hard as I could throw it. Now, between us were like several thousand people, the demonstrators, who probably after several hours of standing around listening to these messages were probably getting a little bit tired of what was going on, a little bored maybe. So all of a sudden there was something happening that was interesting for everybody to watch. And I threw this film, and it kind of went sort of jumping through the air, tossing end over end, sort of like a scene from a movie about the Olympics. But instead of landing right in where Patrick was, it fell short into the crowd. And there was this giant collective groan of people all going, oh, because they had all seen me throwing this film to him, and it didn't make it. And then a few seconds later, this hand pops up out of the crowd, and in it is this roll of film. And it just then gets passed from hand to hand to hand to hand, all the way over like a little caterpillar, right over to where the bus was. And he reached down, and the hand reaches up, and he got the film, and everybody was like, yeah! It was a great moment for journalism. Well, I really had only spent that one time in Tehran. I left in February. I made the mistake of leaving for an R&R day or two in Paris, and it happened to be a very critical day when the government was on the verge of changing hands. But I managed to get back the next day on a chartered plane, and I stayed through to the end of that 7 weeks. But I haven't been back since, and I had not really been there before. So for me, it was a very new place. And when you go to a place for the first time, you're, I think, much more aware and in tune of what's going on. You kind of have a sense of knowing what you don't know. And the more you begin to understand a place, the more comfortable you feel with it. But in Iran, I honestly don't think I can say I ever felt completely comfortable with understanding what was going on or how to find things out. One of the really interesting things is that when I talk to young people now, anybody under the age of 30, they have no idea how you could operate as a photojournalist without a laptop and a cell phone and high-speed data lines and the internet, none of which we had in 1979. The networks were still shooting 16mm film. I was shooting Kodachrome 35mm film and Tri-X black and white, very much old school. But there was no way that you could just operate in the same way that a digital photographer operates now, which is to shoot it and look at it immediately. I mean, we didn't know for days or sometimes weeks if we even had a picture. So you'd write on your caption what you hoped was a picture and please for the editor to look at it and find it. But it didn't always happen, and they didn't always find them. But in many cases, they would find things that you had either forgotten about or didn't think were that sensational, and make them into something sensational.
This is an office that I have in Newburgh, New York, which is when I moved from Arlington, Virginia, up to New York. Just a place where I keep all my gear and pictures, and on the light box, I do editing here on the light box. There's still a lot of stuff that I do that is not done with digital. Like, these are Polaroid prints from trying to test out a camera. I've got all these cameras that I like using that are not, some of these guys are not, it's not a digital camera. It's a real camera. It's a real camera. And, it's one of these guys that has just, whoa. This is how they used to take pictures. You look at those pictures from the White House or Buckingham Palace from 1920. This is what they had. So they crank up the shutter. Focus in here, pull the dark slide, and then when they see the shot, that would be it.